Well, during this time of all this business of the popes, there's things going on that are not just about the popes. We're going to talk about crusades and reforms, chapter 22, and we'll kind of do this in two sections. There were activities and movements in the Western Church that kind of looked like spiritual revival from time to time, spiritual renewal. Some of them were good and sincere. Others had sincere roots, but became sidetracked and came to nothing, or they were based on false doctrine. And so first we want to discuss the Crusades against Islam. This was a big deal, very big deal in church history. And as a matter of fact, to this day, the Islamic world, like elephants who never forget, are still throwing this in the face of Western civilization and Christians, saying, well, you came over and did these horrible things to us. Well, the Crusades took place roughly for 196 years. That's quite a long time for this to have been going on, from the year 1095 to 1291. The war with Islam did not begin as a crusade to liberate the Holy Land. It kind of became that. The church fought against the Moorish Muslims in Spain, if you remember. The Muslims came across North Africa and up into Spain and conquered Spain and held it pretty strongly for a long time. The church saw the Crusades as a holy war against the enemies of the cross. Going back to Gregory the Seventh, which we mentioned last time, he was the one who called for a crusade to liberate Palestine in 1074. However, he was so entangled in controversy over this business that he was going through with Emperor Henry the Fourth from the Holy Roman Empire, that he was not the Pope that started the Crusades. He tried to, but it didn't. He can't do two things sometimes. You got to decide which battle is bigger. The primary reason for the Crusades was into Palestine was religious. It was religious. People were now able to travel a little bit, and so sometimes people who were wealthy would go there as sort of a pilgrimage, to see, like we would today, if you can afford it, to go to the Holy Land and look at it. And many times Christians who went there, and they were free to go there, but they weren't treated very well there because it was held very strongly by Muslims at the time. So the church wanted to liberate the Holy Land from the terror that Christian pilgrims were experiencing and from the false religion of the Muslims. In addition to the religious motive, however, some of the participants in the First Crusade were driven by the hope of economic gain and adventure. You know, this is always going to be the case. It's very sad today that many people go on short-term missions. They don't go on short-term missions. They go on short-term adventures. And they ask the church to support it. And, a person who's going as a missionary needs to be qualified as a missionary, not just a person who says, yeah, I've always liked to see, wherever it is. It is estimated that nearly a million people participated in the very first crusade. The first crusade began as a result of Pope Urban II's preaching against Muslims in 1095. He was literally preaching against Islam. Urban spoke of the need for the Western Church to assist the Eastern Church because the Eastern Church was being overrun by Muslims up in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, Constantinople, etc. And they were actually asking the Western Church for help. And so he says, this is bad. We should do this, and we should deal with these Muslims once and for all. It's argued that Urban was more interested in liberating the Holy Land and expanding his realm, so to speak, and the reach of his power than he really was in helping the Eastern Church. But that's, again, debatable. That's judging motives, and sometimes we can be right and sometimes we can be way off. The crowd responded enthusiastically to Pope Urban's preaching against the Muslims, and by 1096 the enthusiasm had spread and peasants began marching from Europe towards Constantinople, towards Turkey, modern-day Turkey, where the Muslims were invading the Eastern Church. Because these people were ill-prepared, they were not outfitted, they had no knowledge of how to fight, they didn't have any weapons, etc. Many of the early arrivals were either wiped out by the Muslim Turks or sold as slaves. So it was a very tragic first wave. But this was this first attempt was not the first crusade, but only a prelude to the real thing that took place when nobles, not peasants, but when actual people who had authority, power, and armaments and armies started marching from France, from Belgium, from Norman Italy. They came together in Constantinople in 1097. It took just 2 years, and they continued on and captured Jerusalem. And so this first crusade, we could say, was a success in terms of it accomplishing what they set out for. Was that a good thing to set out for? It's debatable. But they did accomplish what they set out to do. The Muslims were no longer pressuring the Eastern Church in Constantinople, and the Holy Land was back under Christian control. Mission accomplished, right? Well, the Muslims didn't give up. By 1145, this is 46 years later, the Muslims were again threatening Jerusalem. In 1146, Bernard of Clairvaux, which we'll talk about him later, he preached for a second crusade. The King of France and the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, who was German, led the second crusade, and they failed. They did not do so well. In 1187, after 41 years of fighting, think about it, 41 years of fighting, the Second Crusade, Jerusalem was still under Muslim control. A 41-year failure. Then there was the Third Crusade. The Third Crusade, which began in 1189, was also known as the King's Crusade. It was given that name because a number of kings actually went. They didn't just send people, they actually went. And we have a list of some of their names here. Philip Augustus of France. Richard the Lionhearted of England. What does that remind you of? Robin Hood, yes. Emperor Frederick Barbarossa of Germany. He was the sitting emperor of the Holy Roman Empire at the time. King Philip of France and King Richard of England traveled to the Holy Land by sea. They got on ships. They went across the Mediterranean Sea to get there. Ironically, Frederick, he went overland because he wanted to avoid the dangers of sea travel. Richard and Philip both arrived safely in Palestine. Ironically, on his land venture to avoid the perils of going at sea, Frederick died because he drowned in a stream, which is just sort of interesting that, we laugh. The guy died. It's not funny, but it is an interesting irony. Richard and Philip are there alone. There's no Frederick to join them, and they didn't get along. I just want to point out something. The French and the English, they never have gotten along. They've never gotten along. You got to wonder. What happened is, since Frederick was gone and since these two couldn't get along, Philip said, "Forget it, I'm leaving." And now we're not going to make any jokes about the French retreating from wars or anything like that. But here he said, "That's it. I don't like you. I'm not going to stay." And so he went home. So now Richard the Lionhearted of England was there to fight on his own. But guess what? All alone, he was unable to do it. He didn't have the strength of his two other allies. He succeeded only in recapturing a place called Acre, in which and in negotiating a deal with Saladin. He got one little spot of land, and he got the Sultan of the Muslims in the Middle East there to allow Christian pilgrims to visit Jerusalem unmolested. They would not be hassled anymore. And who knows whether or not anybody kept the deal. But Richard returned home in 1129 after being away for only 3 years. It's interesting that the 41-year fight was a failure, and the three-year fight, which all the kings turned on each other, and there was a victory on paper, but who knows whether or not we could really call it a victory. That only took 3 years. And then, of course, he had to come home and straighten out Robin Hood. But besides that, the Fourth Crusade was prompted by Pope Innocent III in 1204. We just talked about Innocent III. Since it was initiated by the Pope rather than by the people or state officials, it placed the Eastern Church under control of the Western Church for about 55 years. We mentioned this when we were talking about Innocent. He said, "Let's get this one other crusade." It wasn't necessarily his idea, but when it worked, when the Eastern Church was now under the authority of the Western Church, Innocent took credit for it, and he had that expansion of his kingdom. This crusade was an attempt to capture Egypt as a base of operations for later Middle Eastern campaigns. It really didn't accomplish that. It didn't accomplish that at all. It was more about East versus West in the church than it was about actually accomplishing something in the Middle East. The saddest of the crusades was it's known as the Children's Crusade of 1212. Two preteen kids led a band of like-minded children to the Holy Land. This was dreadfully ill-advised. They believed that their innocence and youth would grant them success. That's very idealistic, but, you know, unless God is really the one leading you, don't expect it to happen. Many of the children who took off towards the Middle East never even made it. They died along the way. Those who did arrive ended up being sold into slavery in Egypt. The Crusade era, which seemed to be accompanied by a measure of religious zeal, continued until 1291. At that time, the Muslims solidly were in control of the Holy Land, and it was that way pretty much until the British came centuries later. What happened as a result of the Crusades? Five things. First, politically, feudalism. Remember we talked about feudalism, sort of a caste system. Feudalism declined because so many lords and nobles sold their land to go to Palestine or died in Palestine, and they never came back. So a lot of the people who were in control died. And it kind of wiped out the people that were higher up in the classes. Economically, trade with the Near East was opened up. It's an ironic thing about the history of warfare. Enemies who are engaged in a war, if there's money to be made, trade will continue. I remember being aghast as a young man reading that an American oil company was offshore in Vietnam, just pumping oil and selling it to the North Vietnamese. And, you know, really? I mean, even as a young teenager, I thought, I mean, that's even worse than disrespecting the flag. But at any rate, number three, the papacy lost some power due to the Crusades. They weren't strong during this time other than Innocent. Doesn't it seem funny to call a guy that? Innocent. Fourth, a sense of nationalism grew among the various European countries. Remember, they were pretty much all consolidated into the Holy Roman Empire. That kind of broke up a little bit after the Carolingian dynasties. And then the papacy had authority over a lot of it. But during the times of the Crusades, nationalism became stronger. The French, the English, the Germans, the Italians to a lesser degree. But the French, the English, and the Germans all kind of emerged more. No, we're our own people here. We're our own people. Nobody's going to tell us what to do. Fifth, the papacy established military orders among monks, so the church now had its own armed forces. Chapter and verse? You know, having a standing army to defend the pope of the papacy and the Roman church? Kind of strange. I got to give one little footnote here on this business of fighting against the Arabs. This is a guy who is so little known in history. And he's very interesting. A man named Raymond Lull. He lived from 1235 to 1315. He was a wildly worldly man. And he was converted. I'm not going to take the time to give you the story of his conversion. If you ask me afterwards, I could tell it to you, but I don't want to put it on tape. He was a very worldly man, and he was sort of miraculously given a revelation by God that he's not living right. And he was converted. And it seems to me, of course, I wasn't there to meet him. I only know him from history. But it seems to me that Raymond Lull was truly a converted man. He started learning Arabic. He started studying the Quran. He started studying Arabic literature. And he said, you know, this crusade thing is the wrong way to do this. We don't need to go over there with armies and fight and kill. What we need to do is go over with the gospel and preach and seek to convert. People began to follow him. Again, history doesn't talk about this guy much. But people began to follow him, and he had a sort of a band of Christian missionaries who went to the Middle East to lead Muslims to faith in Christ. He had three main points that you had to do, three obligations of a person if they were going to be a missionary. They didn't call it that, but a missionary to Muslims. The first one is you have to master the Arabic language. You got to be able to speak the language. That's good. Secondly, you have to know Islamic literature, including the Quran, in order to refute it as being false. Not even necessarily compared to Christianity. It's just it's much of it's false. And third, you need to be willing to give your life for Christ and the gospel. Because if you go, you may not be coming back. Well, he practiced what he preached, because Raymond Lull, on one of his trips, he was deported. They just threw him out. On another one of his trips, he was imprisoned, and he spent quite a bit of time in prison. And you can imagine that the prisons in that day didn't have comfortable beds and color TV. And then he was stoned to death. He gave his life to convert Muslims to faith in Jesus Christ. Now, I know he's only one guy, but I think he deserves some attention. So much attention is given to the Crusades, which were such a mess on so many levels. But the guy who really got it was a converted man who said, you know what they need? It's Jesus. They need the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, after he was martyred, that was kind of the end of that movement. But let it be so today. We don't conquer the world with the sword. We have the sword of the Word of God, and the gospel changes men's hearts and lives. Amen. Well, we'll continue with a sort of a part two here on the Crusades and reforms. Having spoken about the Crusades, we want to talk about a couple of different types of reforms. First, some monastic reforms. There had been reforms of the monastic movement in the past. It got derailed, and the Cluniac reforms, they came to an end. They were good, so to speak, for what they were out to do, but they came to an end because people in the movement became powerful. I mean, this is always what happens. Every good movement of the Spirit eventually seems to get corrupted. And that happened to that. But there are a few other movements that began during this time. The Cistercian Order. This was a movement founded in 1098 by a Benedictine monk named Robert. But he's not the one who gets the credit, really, in history for being the person who made the Cistern order happen. That credit always goes to Bernard of Clairvaux. We mentioned him in an earlier session. He was one who led the movement to greatness. A few things about Bernard's leadership. This movement ended up having over 500 monasteries in Europe. So obviously, in that sense, it was successful. The Cistercians attracted the peasants rather than the wealthy. If you remember, a lot of people would buy their way for a kind of a ne'er-do-well son to go be in the clergy and live in a monastery because he's not going to be any good to the family business anyway, and it'll look good if we can say we got a priest in the family. But wealthy people were, but no, the Cistercian order was more of peasants who did this. The Cistercians emphasized the ascetic life of self-denial. Virtually all of the monastic movements did that. Again, a lot of times they would lose track of that, but this one seemed to stay pretty on focus. They balanced, if you remember, there was a problem in the past of were the monasteries all completely independent, and then some of them would go off because they weren't accountable to anybody, or is it all under the umbrella of the papacy? Well, the Cistercians, they sought for there to be a balance. There's certain things that need to be taking place on the local level because they're there and they know what's going on. But there's other things that say, you know what, we need to be accountable to one another outside. It's kind of like associations of churches, which is a biblical concept, even though the word isn't necessarily in the Bible. They got together on regular basis. The leaders of them would get together. It's sort of like conferences to say, what are we doing? Are we all on the same page? Are we doing the right thing? And then besides the annual, where the leaders of the various monasteries would get together to hold each other accountable and make sure they're still on the same page. During the year, the local monasteries, they were kind of free to do as they did, but then they also were saying, no, we got to stay focused. The Cistercians gave more attention to agriculture than to scholasticism. They weren't necessarily scholars. A lot of them were poor, but they did a lot of things in that way that were good. The founder, Bernard of Clairvaux, was an important person in the church of his day. He seems to have been a deeply spiritual man who championed orthodoxy and true spirituality. He was, interestingly enough, Martin Luther wrote about Bernard of Clairvaux, and he wrote that he says he's worth more. Yeah, you got to understand, once we get to Luther, you'll get this. Luther was a man of like, here it is. I'm saying it like it is. He says Bernard of Clairvaux was worth more than all of the rest of the abbots and monks combined. That was how highly he looked up to Bernard of Clairvaux. He says he was a great man, and he was. He was also a hymn writer. One of my favorite hymns, we kind of only sing it maybe once a year, and that's actually the week before Easter, during when we're thinking about the death of Christ. He wrote a hymn, Sacred Heart Now Wounded. It's a beautiful hymn. A lot of hymnals ascribe it to somebody else, but no, it seems that that was one that he wrote in Latin and was translated later. I just love one of the lines from it. He says at the end of one of the verses, "Let me never, never outlive my love for thee. I don't ever want to fall away, Lord. Don't let me." He's a very pious man. So that was a little bit about the Cistercians and Bernard of Clairvaux. There were also military orders, which we already mentioned very briefly in a previous session, talking about something that came out of the Crusades, was that the papacy now has their own military. They're known today as the Swiss Guard. If you've ever even, if you've been there, you've seen them. If you've been to Rome and seen what's there, you see the Swiss Guard, or even if you've just seen them on TV, and forgive me, I mean seriously, they look like, they're dressed in like court jester outfits. They look absolutely absurd, and they carry, you know, long poles with hatchets on the top, and it's like, you know, really. But at any rate, where in the Bible does it say the church is supposed to have a military? Oh, yeah, that's right. Nowhere. Anyway, there was another one, the friars. The friars were much the same as the monks, but there was exceptions. Instead of separating from the world, which is what the monks did, the friars went out into the world. Ah, that's a good thing. Secondly, instead of working to be self-supporting, they survived on the offerings and people whom they served. Now, that may at surface sound bad, but isn't that what happens to clergy? This is what happens. I mean, the Apostle Paul writes about this. In at least a couple of places in the New Testament, that the church has the responsibility to support their ministers. A couple of noteworthy orders of friars are the Dominicans and the Franciscans, and they are very different from one another. The Franciscans, as we said in a previous session, were founded by St. Francis of Assisi. He lived from 1182 to 1226. Francis was a very worldly young man. He was from wealth. And he was just kind of wild and profligate and lived a wild life. He had a life-threatening illness. And while he was coming out of that illness, a deep fever in which they thought he would die, he revived, he came back. And when he came back, he was changed. God did something in that young man's heart. And he dedicated himself to a life of poverty, chastity, and obedience, including obedience to the Pope. And again, the Pope in his day was Innocent III. So what did he know? Francis and his small band of followers were thought to be mad by most people because they lived in poverty and they had the funny haircuts and all. But they were given approval by Pope Innocent III in 1209, which we mentioned in a previous session. There was a couple of other groups that emerged from them. It was like an order of women. They didn't call them nuns. They were called clares. And then there was an order of laymen because most of the Franciscans were clergy, but there was also laymen who wanted to live the life of a Franciscan, but they already had families and they couldn't leave their homes. And so these were called the tertiaries, I think is how you say it, which mainly just means third from Italian. The Franciscans were missionary-minded. Francis went from his native Italy to Spain, to Morocco, Syria, Egypt in 1219, and preached before the Sultan of Egypt. While in Egypt, leadership of the Franciscan order was taken away from Francis and placed in other hands, and new rules came. And Francis was so humble, he said, "Okay, if this is the Lord's will." And he was led in a different direction. The new leadership The ministry was in a new direction. The new leadership of the Franciscans to missionary efforts, they went as far as China back in those days, which is huge. The only problem is the message they took was, you know, not a very clean edition of Christianity. History says that they made 36,000 converts in China back in the 1300s. Pretty amazing missionaries. Because in those days, missionaries, there wasn't much missionary activity. 68 years later, after the 36,000 Chinese were converted, the Ming Dynasty in China came into power and they destroyed the Chinese church. And the Chinese church has kind of been had problems in China ever since. The Franciscans continued to pursue missions, doing much of the missionary work in the New World, California in particular. Junipero, Sierra, you know, it was the Franciscans who put all the missions along the California coast and what have you. Other notable Franciscans include William of Ockham, a man whose writings profoundly influenced the Reformation. We'll talk more about him when we get to the Reformation. While Franciscans ministered to the heart, the Dominicans, well, they sought to minister to the head. They wanted to make converts. They were very aggressive, very militant. They were an order founded by a Spanish priest named Dominic, 1170 to 1221. His vision was to win heretics to the Orthodox faith through preaching, through reason. It was officially, his ministry was officially sanctioned by the papacy in 1216. It is interesting, good people were from the Dominicans, although the Dominicans have more of a bad history than a good history. Thomas Aquinas was probably the greatest Roman Catholic theologian, and he was right about a lot. A lot of Protestants discard him because he was a Catholic, and there's a lot of things that he wrote which we would say, no, I don't think that's right. But there was a ton of things that Thomas Aquinas was right about. R.C. Sproul is a big fan of Thomas Aquinas. Savonarola was a Dominican. He was good. He got a little bit political during the time when the Medici family was trying to take over the papacy in Florence and in Rome, and he kind of got involved politically there. But he was kind of another one of the forerunners in some ways of what took place later in the Reformation. I'm going to come back to the Dominicans, but for a moment, let me just talk about some lay reform movements. Most of these were clergy, other than the small subgroup of the Franciscans. The clergy sought spiritual revival through renewal movements within the church. Spiritually minded laymen also wanted to be involved in this, which is good. And they sought to go outside the Church of Rome. And unfortunately, sometimes they didn't do so well. Sometimes they did really well. An example of each. By the way, is it written here in the manual? What we know about these movements is largely what was written by the Roman Catholic Church that was opposed to them a lot. And so what's written about them tends to be more negative because, you know, the people who write the history are the ones who put their spin on it. One of the groups, the Albigenses, they were reading the Bible. We mentioned this in an earlier. They were reading the Bible, but they came to the wrong conclusions, and they ended up following an old heresy, Manichaeism, and their interpretations of scriptures, that there's a dualistic thing. There's the God of the Old Testament, the God of the New, and then there's also, even more importantly, just the fact that there's good and evil and they're equal opposites. Listen, good and evil are not equal opposites. God is the only self-existent, uncreated being, and everything and everyone else is created. They're not equal opposites. They may be opposites, but they're not equal. And as we said earlier, the church's way of fighting the error that came from reading the Bible incorrectly was to forbid reading the Bible. Not exactly the best. And then Pope Innocent authorized their extermination. You know, if you don't like the people who oppose you, get rid of them. But also during this era, in 1176, a wealthy business named Peter Waldo. Where's Waldo from? No, it's not the same one. He read the New Testament, and he was so taken with all what he read that he had immense wealth, and he sold it all and began to follow Christ, and others began to follow him as well. The group was known as the Poor Men, later known as the Waldenses from Waldo. He was good, and we could say he was also somewhat of a forerunner of the Reformation. These men desired to preach the gospel, but they were forbidden to do so by the Pope. Again, why? For fear that they might say something that wasn't pro-Rome or pro-Pope. Was it because the heads of the Catholic Church knew that if they preached the Bible that they would be preaching against the papacy? I don't know. But clearly it is. Just look forward in history to Martin Luther. What happened? A Roman Catholic Augustinian monk was reading the Bible, teaching the Bible in a seminary, and said, you know, what I'm reading here is not what my church is about. And so maybe the church knew that was going to happen even before. So they were all excommunicated, the lot of them. The Waldenses were all excommunicated in 1184, but they kept preaching. And their preaching was orthodox. The group believed and taught that every Christian, talk about forward-looking, they taught that every Christian should have a copy of the Bible in his own language. Folks, this is in 1184. I mean, it would be virtually a physical impossibility to do that because the printing press hadn't been invented yet. I mean, to copy the whole Bible, that took years to produce enough Bibles to do even nothing, much less to really do something. The Waldenses taught that the New Testament is the sole authority for all matters of faith and practice. What's that saying? Not the papacy, not the church, but the Bible, the New Testament. They were the true forerunners of the Protestant Reformation, and they were 300 years beforehand, at least, before even the earliest among them. There were about 35,000 Waldensians, there are about 35,000 Waldensians in northern Italy to this day. It's kind of interesting that the Lord has allowed them to remain. It's a small group, really, but 35,000, but, you know, they're just up the street from Rome to this day, which I think is kind of interesting. There were other groups with wildly incorrect ideas that came about, and one of Rome's ways to deal with them, sometimes you could argue what they did to deal with heresy was worse than the heresy itself. And this is where the rest of the story on the Dominicans comes in. The Dominicans became the arm of enforcement for the Roman Church when it came to doctrine. They were commissioned by Pope Gregory the Ninth to punish heresy. Not to convert people, but to punish heresy. Not to help people see the error of their ways and to convert them, but to punish heresy. And this led to the Inquisition, during which many were tortured, burned at the stake for believing, or even being accused of believing something that was contrary to what the Roman Church approved of. In Rome's defense, now go with me here for a second. Pay close attention to what I'm going to say. In Rome's defense, if their premise was correct, then what they did would be correct. Their premise was, if we torture a person physically and literally torture them, maybe even to death, if it brings about a conversion to Christ, doesn't that make it worth it? Because an eternal salvation is so much more to be valued than ease of life here. Now, if that premise was correct, that you could actually torture someone into believing, then you could. The only problem is the premise isn't correct. If you have a false premise, your conclusion is going to be even falser, to coin a new word here. And so literally, that's what they did. And the reality is, no amount of torture on earth can be compared to the terror of hell, but no amount of torture can convert anybody. It's absolutely sad and tragic. Torture can't save people. And so they were wrong. So Rome's correct logic was based on a false premise. May God have mercy on the souls of those who participated or condoned torture and execution of heretics. Last thought. Through thick and thin. And is it true? We're seeing in church history some thick, some good, and a lot of thin, not so good. But you know what we know throughout all of it? King Jesus is still in control. And as we sang before we started this morning, His kingdom cannot fail. Be comforted, Christians. Be comforted.